Good morning, and welcome to First Coast Connect. I'm Ann Schindler. First, with a former Duval County school teacher expected to enter a plea for his criminal case, is the school district doing enough to investigate teacher complaints? Then, the St. Augustine Film Festival unspools their celluloid agenda for January. Plus, Sweet Pete's needs your help finding a troublesome elf. But first, it's one of the jewels of Duval County's magnet school system, a place designed to help art students thrive in a creative and supportive environment. But that reputation has suffered, as allegations of teacher misbehavior and even criminal conduct have raised concerns about the school district's lack of oversight or investigative backbone. We're hearing today from a lawyer and former parent of a student at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, as well as a former student who has led the charge to force change in the school and at Duval County School District headquarters. Attorney and former Douglas Anderson parent, Chris Moser, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Shyla Jenkins, a former Douglas Anderson student and alumni activist. Welcome, Shyla.
Thank you.
Have you ever complained about a teacher to school officials? What kind of response did you receive? Give us a call at 549-2937 or email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook and Instagram pages or tag us on X at FCC On Air. Shyla, I want to start with you. The longtime chair of the vocal department at Douglas Anderson had been expected to enter a guilty plea this week in a case involving lewd conduct with a student. Now, that scheduled court date has been pushed to January, but as a former Douglas Anderson student, was the news that Jeffrey Clayton had been arrested, cuffed, handcuffed on campus, and taken off, was that a surprise to you?
I mean, I think it was a surprise to everyone because people had been complaining for so long. If you look at the history of the complaints going back to, you know, as far back as like 2006, 2010, people, both students, parents, you know, individuals in the classrooms were alerting the administration or alerting, you know, the district to this problem. So to have him arrested was huge. And I would say my phone blew up that day because DA, we're all very still close as alumni. And the resounding word was finally.
And you say there had been complaints going back as far as 2010. Was that widely known among the student population?
I don't know if it was widely known among the student population, but it was known among the alumni. It was known, you know, in the teacher atmosphere. I mean, people knew. It was not a secret.
And how did you learn about it? What actually happened? Was it your phone starting to blow up, as you said?
Basically, yeah. Everyone was like, turn on the news. Clayton's on the news. He's been arrested. And we were just all kind of shocked and sitting there going, I mean, we'd heard this for years and no one could prove it. And finally, they did.
And so when did you become more involved and why did you become more involved?
That's a great question. So when I got involved, it was because, you know, I wanted to make sure that the kids that had been victimized got it a chance and to be, you know, heard. And not only that, but for something to happen. And in 2020, I'd come forward when they did the investigation into the school with, you know, all of the racist and racism complaints and had said something about Mr. Clayton and what I'd heard, and what I'd experienced as a student there. And people were like, oh, that's so, you know, oh, my gosh, that's so awful. Absolutely. We'll look into it. Nothing happened. So when this happened in 2023, I was like, I'm not going to just hand this off. I'm going to continue to come forward. I'm going to continue to, you know, garner people's letters and understanding, you know, what they went through and really bring that to the school board, which is what I did in April.
And since then, since the arrest and your, you know, kind of advanced involvement, you've really been at the forefront of this. You've been outspoken. You've been at a lot of meetings. Describe the role that you've played.
Yeah. So it has morphed into this role of understanding how this can occur. How can something like this be allowed to fester for decades? And what I have found is that we do not have clear policies in communicating with parents. Why a teacher is pulled out of the classroom, why they are put back in the classroom. And this is to protect not only the students, but the teachers as well. You know, if there's allegations that are brought forth that are false, they should have something that protects them and explains, you know, what happened. We don't have that. You know, we're looking to create that. And I say we in the sense that the board is looking at this right now, trying to figure out how do we do this correctly. But what we have in place is totally inaccurate.
We have a comment from Chris on X. He says something you might want to look at or look into rather, is how staff of color face disproportionate punishment and how the district has clamped down on the Gay Straight Alliance clubs. One sponsor was recently hounded out of the district and several clubs have gone underground. Not necessarily directly related to this, but Chris Moser, let's talk about your role in this. You're an attorney. You've had experience litigating cases involving teacher misconduct, but you're also an educator and the parent of a former DA student. So what did you think when you first learned about the allegations against Jeffrey Clayton in particular?
Okay. I think I have to answer that from those three different perspectives. And as a parent, I was initially shocked, but also delighted to see that law enforcement went into the building and arrested someone for a serious crime. As the days went on, I started getting phone calls from parents who I guess learned indirectly about some past cases I've worked on involving a St. John's County teacher who was also in the arts, by the way, in a magnet school. And I quickly became more outraged and angry as I spoke to alumni from all over the country telling me lots of very similar things that Shyla, I'm sure we'll get into a little bit.
Had you heard of Jeffrey Clayton? I mean, were you familiar with who he was and the allegations that had been kind of circulating around him?
I didn't hear about any allegations relating to Jeffrey Clayton as a parent until approximately a week before he was arrested.
And what did you hear and from who?
I heard some, I guess, students casually sort of explain in a social setting to me what they have observed. And I couldn't believe it. And I was actually on vacation and came back and shortly after he was arrested. So I can't remember the specifics of what I heard, but it was inappropriate and alarming boundary type things.
You've been involved in some federal litigation involving teachers, a teacher in St. John's County in particular. Is there any similarities that you see between the case against Jeffrey Clayton, the allegations? And to be clear, he hasn't changed his plea yet. So at the present time, he still has pleaded not guilty, but it's our understanding that he is going to change that plea at some point soon. But have you seen similar patterns of behavior or the accusations? Are they at all similar in terms of the federal case that you previously had in St. John's County?
I mean, there's some similarities and there's some differences. I guess what I'd like to talk a little bit about is the perspective of, well, first of all, you know, I am an educator. I'm not here in that capacity, but I'm also here kind of like as an attorney. And the similarities are, I think, very common, not just in cases I've handled, but in the nation. We're seeing lots of multiple instances of teacher misconduct that have been covered up and are now disclosed. And there's lots of reasons for that. And I think the arts and institutions that have stellar reputations or used to have stellar reputations, such as, you know, the Boy Scouts, for example, the brand and the attachments that the alumni have and the parents have because they made those decisions to with great sacrifice sometimes, you know, enroll their child there because they think that is in, you know, their best interest, and they're going to be in front of people they can trust, people that they want to one day be like. It's the similarities, I guess, to try to answer the question, are very similar, but it's not just, this is just like St. John's, but it's just like the victims in a Catholic church who, you know, priests used their religion, the things that they cared about the most, to exploit them.
How does that overlap with like an art school, for instance?
Well, I brought a couple of documents to speak in very general ways because of the litigation that is going to be occurring. I guess one example is a lottery letter from 2011 about the magnet program and congratulating a family of a student who completed the lottery and was admitted to that school.
To Douglas Anderson?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And on the left side of the form letter has, you know, the executive director and the assistant and sort of the organizational chart stuff. But I think just reading some of what you see when you're lucky enough to get selected on merit, by the way, because it's audition only, it is incredibly competitive. I live in St. John's County. My child went to Douglas Anderson. And the way I would try to explain it to a lot of my friends who are parents who thought I was crazy for taking the time to drive him back and forth is, look, for the price of gas and for the time, it is essentially like me being able to put him in the best situation, akin to the paid expensive private schools, you know, and I'm talking about Bowles and I'm talking about Episcopal, and I'm sure they have their own problems too. But on the left of this letter that I received from a friend of Dean Simmons who did put their name on a complaint that Shyla can speak to, I'm sure, says this: a Duval County public high school in bold, then a litany of awards and accolades, the National Grammy Signature School, Grammy Foundation, National Model School of Excellence, International Center for Leadership Education, Best Academic High Schools, Newsweek, 10 years, High School Jazz Competition winner, the Essentially Duke Ellington, Top 100 Public High Schools, U.S. News and World Report.
So obviously a lot of, praise for the school, for the institution in general. And Shyla, is that what attracted you to Douglas Anderson in the first place?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it was and it still is the school, the only school in Duval County that is, you know, geared towards art. So you have an entire influx of kids who are passionate about their art and they come to this school looking to grow. And to Chris's point, you know, when I started in 99, the atmosphere was very different. It was that, you know, feeling of you're here to nurture your art. And by the time I graduated in 2002, it had changed. It had become a school with a brand. And with brand comes, you know, the talent behind that that is, you know, used as just the way that we win awards. And it was not considered anymore that place to grow. It was the place to perform. And so what people in my, you know, class and other classes after us have talked about is the fact that, you know, the reason we think a lot of this went unchecked for a long time is it would tarnish the brand of Douglas Anderson. And, you know, we couldn't have that happen because that school relies on public and private funding.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to attorney Chris Moser and former Douglas Anderson student Shyla Jenkins. We're talking about concerns about teacher oversight at Douglas Anderson and as well through the Duval County District as a whole. You can call us at 549-2937 or email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org You can also message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook and Instagram pages, or tag us on X at FCC on air. And Shiloh, that's an interesting point that you raised in terms of the pressure being on to participate in maintaining the reputation that Douglas Anderson has, not just here in Jacksonville, but really, you know, regionally and around the country in terms of a school of excellence. Talk about how that maybe prevented some people or encouraged people not to speak out.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I think people don't understand how the power dynamic is very skewed at DA. And these art directors, Clayton was an arts director, have the ability to not only, you know, not have you perform, but they can also impact where you go. And a lot of what I've heard in the chatter out there is like, well, not everyone's going to make it to Broadway or Nashville or LA. And that's true. But at the same time, we're talking about just graduating, because these arts directors control the horizontal and vertical. If you, you know, if you're not up to what they want, or maybe they have an issue with you, then things can be lost. I've seen people, you know, turn in paperwork or turn in their critiques when I was there, and, you know, they magically just didn't happen, and then they get an F for the class. Like, that's the kind of power they have. And people are like, oh, well, you know, they're complaining because they didn't get a part or they weren't in a special group. No, I'm talking about just the physical form of graduating. And, you know, I don't think it should cost a student's dignity for 4 years to walk across that stage and get a diploma. I think there should be some accountability that's being held by these, you know, who's over these arts directors, because they infiltrate into everything. They write your recommendation letters. They have all the contacts. They know, they can blacklist you, not just from the play, but from the community. And that's what, you know, is so very, very dynamic at DA. And that's something we want to, you know, kind of shine a light on, because it's so different than any other school.
Chris, I want to ask you about that power dynamic. I mean, we should point out that most of the teachers, I think almost all of the teachers, right, at Douglas Anderson are exceptional. They do a great job. They're incredibly gifted artists and teachers, and do a wonderful job. The oversight has been kind of the issue in terms of when there have been complaints, following through on that. But what is specifically different about the role of a teacher at an art school as opposed to at a non-art school? How do they interact differently with the students?
Well, speaking about a musical teacher or choral teacher in general, they have at the front end just essentially an illusion of a permission to touch, right?
Explain that.
Well, let me adjust how your breathing is. Let me position this instrument in this way. And that we know from past federal reports on like No Child Left Behind, we know who the most likely to offend are. And specifically, it is those dynamics. And then the other is teachers who happen to coach. And that doesn't mean that other people don't abuse. It doesn't mean that, you know, bus drivers or guidance counselors or principals can't also abuse children. But we kind of have a sort of like a profile. And so
that's teachers who are involved in some sort of exceptional role with a student or in a coaching position.
It can be, and it certainly seems to be in Mr. Clayton's case, but it can also be a toxic culture, and that leads to not just one bad actor, but in speaking to so many alumni, there was a period of time where there was several teachers who were not fit to be in front of kids. And the question for me is, given the amount of sheer complaints on Mr. Clayton that are in his personnel file, how is it that, and I don't represent the child who triggered this arrest, but how is it that a DCF employee and a Clay County Sheriff's deputy became aware of this and went to the home of that child? And that is how the victim's parents became aware of the incident. And for me as a parent, that is absolutely unacceptable.
What would, I'm not clear, you're talking about the student whose charges led to the arrest of Jeffrey Clayton?
Yes. Yes.
And how would, how should they have been notified?
Well, I mean, I just don't understand how he could have so many complaints in his personnel file. And this might speak to past events that have just allowed him to be there. And, you know, I don't want to be all over the place, and I feel like I could speak about this for hours, but it's, we all know people who do this work that there's always common themes, and it's not necessarily because it's an art school. It could be a camp for sports. It could be a gymnastic camp. It could be anything. But what we know is that abuse took place over a number of years. We now know it wasn't just one teacher back then. There might be just Mr., you know, there might be a few people who were hired back then that the, that were allowed to stay. But it's the use of the passion of the art and a gatekeeper into wanting to be that person that is insidious to me.
Shyla, you have done a number of public records requests over since this began. Talk a little bit about your experience requesting those records, obtaining those records, and what you found.
Yeah, I would say the first one I did was, of course, for Clayton, and it took, I would say, about a month to get that. And obviously, the media was looking for it. Everybody was looking for it. So that got to us pretty quickly in terms of what I've been told through, you know, people I've talked to. And but there's been other requests that we've been waiting for, you know, 6 to 8 months on. I mean, for Corey Thayer's file, it took, I think, Chris, 5 months to get that. For me to get the email that was sent to Dr. Diana Green about Clayton in 2020 from a former teacher. That took 8 months to get.
Talk about that document in particular, because not everybody's going to be familiar with that. Dr. Diana Green obviously is a former superintendent. She says she left voluntarily. A lot of people think that this, among other issues, resulted in her being forced out. But that this played no small role, the scandal at Douglas Anderson. And we should be clear, it wasn't just Jeffrey Clayton, but you mentioned Corey Thayer. He was a teacher that was removed from the classroom and then kind of returned and then removed again. So when you're talking about requesting a letter that Dr. Diana Green received, that was about Jeffrey Clayton, and that was...
Yes. So that email was sent in 2020, I think 2021. It was by a former teacher who worked with Mr. Clayton in the vocal department. And she basically laid out all of the bad behavior she saw, her concerns as a vocal professional, how she felt it was a environment of grooming. And that email got to Dr. Green. There was a response from Dr. Green, and that email was forwarded to the Office of Professional Standards, and people were supposed to take action on that. The person who sent the email, Rebecca Lohr, was very much, you know, kind of given this, oh my God, you know, yeah, absolutely, we'll deal with this. And nothing happened. And you got to think, that's 2020. So here we are, 2023, he's arrested. So, I mean, I know there were a lot of things that led up to that. And, you know, Dr. Diana Green being asked to or forced to remove or being asked to step down because there were also, you know, files that were sent into the state that were, I guess, mislabeled or not sent in correctly. And there was this whole kind of issue on top of the DA thing. But, you know, when we went there to talk about, they had a meeting specifically for DA that turned into the Save Dr. Green show. And what was so just disheartening to me is, once again, we're here to talk about a very relevant issue. We're sidelined because the media and the press was all about saving that job. And I don't necessarily know or follow Dr. Green and what she did. You know, so I can't really speak to that. But she should not have been the only one who was let go. There should be a massive clean house of, you know, just kind of positions in there, starting with HR, high school superintendents, people who knew for decades. And, you know, she was just the figurehead that they went after. They didn't take out the other people who for decades allowed this to happen. And that's what's so frustrating.
Now, we've heard anecdotally, at least, that the Office of Professional Standards that kind of handles these complaints is understaffed, that they're overworked, that they're getting multiple new investigations every week that they have to contend with, even with this giant backlog. And, you know, that's sort of a system designed to fail. What is the role of school board members, though, Chris, in this? You have made, or at least obtained, a public records request that I think calculated how many emails each of the school board members received about these teachers specifically. What did those numbers show?
Well, I found this doing my investigation, and a educator had posted this on social media, and I contacted that person and they shared it with me. And what it showed was, and this is a public records request made a month prior to Mr. Clayton's arrest, and the ask was for all complaints and information on conduct sent to Scott Schneider regarding Jeffrey Clayton.
Who's Scott Schneider?
I don't have my organizational chart in front of me.
High school superintendent.
Yeah. But yeah. So, and again, this is not my request. This is somebody else's request. But from parents, students, teachers, administrators, DCPS employees, and other stakeholders between June 1st, 2019 and February 20th, 2020, this includes complaints sent to Scott Schneider directly, as well as those forwarded to him. He received, according to the response, 675 emails. The next request made through public records was all complaints and information on conduct sent to any DCPS school board members regarding Jeffrey Clayton from parents, students, teachers, administrators, DCPS employees, or other stakeholders between that same time period. Lori Hershey, 178 emails. Warren Jones, 203. Charlotte Joyce, 257. Daryl Willie, 155. Kelly Coker, 173. Cindy Pearson, 82. And April Charney, 2. And past board members were also listed.
What does that tell you about, I mean, obviously they received some notification. We all get a lot of emails. What's your expectation with those kind of numbers and notifications?
You know, as an employee in an institution, I'm a mandatory reporter. And so if I was a parent writing a school board member personally, to me, that would be like, I'm at the end of my rope. I have gone to the people I was told would help me, you know, and I haven't talked to all these people yet. But to me, that's just reaching out to the people that are elected to help fix the problem. And it's just stunning to me, the sheer number in that short period of time on one person.
We've got a call, Gail from Duval. I believe Gail is a retired music teacher. Good morning, Gail. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning. Thank you for this conversation. It is inexcusable, of course, the accusations regarding Jeffrey Clayton. But the thing that prompted my call was the discussion regarding perhaps a task force or such, having oversight with fine arts teachers or specialist teachers. I just wanted to make this comment as a caution. When an arts teacher or any specialist teacher is really, when they're trained, they know what they're doing. And there is a way, I just want to share this, there is a way to appropriately and a necessity to touch a student, but there is a way to do it that is not offensive at all. And one of the reasons as a singer, that connection would be necessary is to understand that thing called diaphragmatic breathing. And it's usually done in a one-on-one setting, not a choral setting, as the accusations are with Jeffrey Clayton. And I'll just make this as go in the athletics arena. When a baseball player is doing that follow through with swinging a bat, sometimes you'll see a coach behind a student, a child, and having them feel that follow through. That's one of those things that involves touch, but it's not at all inappropriate. So I just wanted to make sure that parents don't hear the discussion that was done in this conversation and run away and try to tell specialist teachers how to interact or teach their craft, because that would be a failure in education.
A fair comment. Thank you, Gail. Chris?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And I've been speaking to vocal coaches, and my son has a vocal coach now. And so I know that there are ways to do it. Sometimes teachers use the student's hand on top of their hand. Sometimes they merely ask, you know, I'd like to touch your back now. May I do that? You know, and I think that that is necessary in teaching someone how to sing properly and how to use their voice. And so I don't want to give anybody the impression that that's not part of the job. But this police report involves a private lesson with a ninth grader and a 65-year-old man, probably in a soundproof room. and I don't know what to do about minors in those settings, because I teach in a college and it is different. But we do have to be mindful of protecting the child's safety, physical and emotional well-being while these things are happening, because things can be misconstrued. I mean, I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I only got involved in this type of work because people couldn't find attorneys, you know? And it's a very difficult place. I try to see things from multiple perspectives. I'm married to an artist. So I understand the complexity. And I think there is a way, just like an administrator, you can protect the institution and you can protect the people in it, and you can do it the right way. And this seems to me like circle the wagons, plausible deniability. I kind of was describing it at dinner with my family, and I basically said something like an educational cartel, right? It's like the people who were doing the worst during the time that students like Shyla attended were low-level people, and now those people have gone through the ranks and are the decision makers, and they have an interest in protecting their jobs and protecting, you know, the reputation of DA, and they're failing the children, and and these kids deserve as much due process as anybody else.
Shyla, just as we're wrapping up here, what is happening now with these cases, and what, if anything, is your sense of what has changed or what still needs to?
I mean, as far as it goes policy-wise, we're still working on it. The board is still discussing this. You know, we have not made the strides I would have liked to have seen now here in December from the time in April that this all came to, you know, light. I know the wheels of policymaking and government don't move fast, but I would have loved to have seen more communication from the board. It feels like at times there's been very much that void of what's happening, what's going on. It hasn't been on the agenda items. And we were promised, you know, when this all started in May with the investigation, that we'd have transparency, that we'd understand more. We were promised in October the investigation in DA would wrap up. We would have a report. That is still yet to happen. And even the board doesn't know. So in my conversations with them, they're frustrated. And my you know, whole plea is figure it out. You know, we've elected you to do that. we want you to be involved and we want you to communicate to us what you're doing. Even if it's just, hey, we're still investigating, we're still doing this, it's better than the silence we've been getting. And, you know, my whole goal is to save DA and to, you know, change the culture that has been allowed to permeate at that school for so long, because it is such a great school for kids and artists.
Shyla Jenkins, Chris Moser, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And we'll be right back with a sneak peek at the First Coast Premier Film Festival next month. Who is on their own, I wonder? And who has cast this spell? Welcome back. I'm joined now by Gregory von Hosch, the founder of the St. Augustine Film Festival. He's also the founder of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival. And this year, the St. Augustine Film Festival returns for its 14th year. So welcome, Greg. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks, Anne. This is a perfect format for me because all of my audience listens to this show and the station. So it's a great place for me to get the word out.
Excellent. Well, we're glad to have you. So let's start a little bit with just about you. What drew you to film in the first place?
I went to the University of Florida and I graduated in theater there, and I founded the Hippodrome State Theater, and I was there for 15 years as artistic director. And while we were doing that, we were working a lot with theater that was written for the screen. And so we would adapt things. We worked with Tennessee Williams. He came in. We did a world premiere of Tiger Tail, world premiere of Next Stop Greenwich Village. They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Carnal Knowledge. A lot of films we put on stage first and worked with the filmmakers. And we always had a very cinematic approach to theater. We would use slides. And this is before video, before VHS, before any of that. So we'd use slides and music and transitions, a lot of different ways to convey time lapse and things like that, and setting a location. And so I was always very interested in it. And a lot of the great dramatists in the late 60s then started migrating to film. And film became more of a accessible medium for people to thrive in. So I always had an interest in it, and it was a logical progression, at least for me.
Talk a little bit about the Hippodrome, because that really is a landmark theater in Florida. You were foundational in founding it.
Right.
And tell, for people who may not be familiar, though, kind of what it is, where it is in Gainesville. It's in a beautiful, historic, restored building.
Right. Well, when we started, I graduated in 72, and in 73, I started the Hippodrome. And it was a challenge just finding somebody that would rent to us, a bunch of old ex-hippies. And we finally found a place out on Hawthorne Road. Everybody thought it was an old 7-Eleven, but it was really a plumbing warehouse. And when you went into it, there was an actual basement and all this stuff with plumbing supplies. And the gentleman that rented it to us was a local racist. And so we had to hide all of our political viewpoints and everything because we kept getting turned down by people. No, no, not here. What are you going to do? Oh, you're a bunch of hippies. Oh, my goodness. But we thrived in that little place where we'd seat about 70 people. We moved out to a steel warehouse out by Sears and Dubs, if you know that area. And that was my favorite of the three places, a huge warehouse where we could transform it completely for anything. And then as we developed more and more of a following, the city approached us about taking over the old post office downtown, a 1903 Beaux-Arts classic post office. And so that's where we are now and have been since 1979.
So you founded, this is the 35th year, I think, of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, which is a very prestigious.
It's actually our 38th year, yeah. And I didn't found it. I came in, and this is my 35th year, and so I've been there for 35 years.
I gotcha. So you joined it in progress, but still, right. It's been very successful. Mm-hmm. Why did you bring a film festival to St. Augustine?
Well, I wanted to run away from home. I was living in Fort Lauderdale, and no offense, Fort Lauderdale, but it was getting too big and too much. I couldn't go to Publix without people saying, hey, my tickets weren't at the box office. The air conditioning wasn't working. The bathrooms haven't been cleaned, you know, things like that. So I just wanted to run away. I told my board I could write the grants and do the programming from a remote location. So I moved up to St. Augustine. And after I was here for a couple of years, the Flagler College president, Hebert, approached me about starting a film festival under the guidance of the college. And I thought, okay, a little film thing every once in a while won't be so bad. But it mushroomed, and people really loved it because there was nothing like that in St. Augustine. It's all history, nature, music, and film doesn't even rate in the top 10. So I think people were starving for that kind of recreation something that would bring in films from around the world, from the major metropolitan centers, from American independence, and that's what we've been able to do.
So you're going to have to tell me what is coming up at this film festival and give me your highlights.
Okay, the highlights. Our opening night film is called The Senior. It stars Michael Chiklis, Mary Stuart Masterson, and a bunch of unknown people. It's a true story about a guy that was kicked out of college where he was the captain of his football team for fighting. He had, like, anger management issues. Fast forward 40 years, he's at a reunion of the football team that he was kicked off of, and one of the guys says to him, Mike, you know, you got 1 year of eligibility left. He says, what? He was 59 years old. He goes back to college, tries out, makes the team, and it's a true story. So the guy that is Mike Flint, the subject of the film, will be there for the screening. The director, Rod Lurie, who's a West Point graduate, will be there. And Mary Stuart Masterson, who portrays a wife, the wife will be there, and we're working on Mary Stuart now. So that was one of my highlights.
You're going to have to give me now a couple of the next major highlights and where people can get their film festival tickets.
Okay, yes. First of all, go to stogfilmfest.com, stogfilmfest.com, and you can get all your tickets. You can buy a pass. You can see all of the 40 or so different films we have from around 30 countries.
And a couple of big names coming.
Wendy Malick, who's best known probably for Just Shoot Me, Dream On, Melora Hardin, best known probably for The Office. She was the girlfriend of Steve Carell.
Jan Levison.
Yeah, and then also Pamela Portier, Sydney Portier's daughter's coming in for a documentary on her dad, and a lot of different things.
Well, Gregory Van Hoosh, thank you so much for being here today. The St. Augustine Film Festival begins what day?
It begins on the 11th of January.
Thanks so much for being here. Stick around, we'll be right back with Jacksonville's very own Candyman, Pete Berringer.
The Law Offices of Phillips and Hunt proudly support WJCT, personal injury, criminal defense, and family law. Phillips and Hunt, committed to justice. 904-444-4444 or floridajustice.com.
Life South Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with Life South helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
As a WJCT News 89.9 listener, you might take it for granted that when you turn on the radio, somebody you trust is going to be there, like Ann Schindler on First Coast Connect, or Stephen Ponson and Dan Scanlon covering local news. They're just a few of the people you count on at WJCT News 89.9 for information you can trust to be accurate, balanced, and thorough. Call us now at 353-9528 or give online at wjct.org/radio.
Hi, it's me, Vincent Taylor, Jacksonville educator, author, and creator of the Cornbread series. Come see me at Teach for the afternoon keynote session. If instruction isn't engaging, I quit. Where I talk about highly effective strategies to engage students. See you on Saturday, February 10th at the Hyatt Regency Jacksonville. Get your early bird tickets today for only $40 at wjct.org/teach.
The United Arab Emirates is already proving a controversial choice as the venue for this year's UN Climate Change Summit. Will its oil-rich hosts succeed where others have failed?
It's simply not enough for us to be trying to try.
Next time on 1A, we look at the deals that move beyond expressions of intent and ask whether rich countries are now ready to compensate poor ones for the damage caused by climate-related disasters.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Come on, and we're back. Baby. Downtown confection purveyor Sweet Pete's is having an elf problem. Unlike the more benign elf on the shelf, the downtown candy shop says its local elf iteration is causing holiday mayhem, and it's asking for the public's help. I'm joined now by Candyman Pete Berenger, owner of Sweet Pete's. Pete's, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
So tell us, what kind of elf mischief you've been experiencing at Sweet Pete's?
So we've been experiencing all kinds of stuff. Jolly Pop has been causing mayhem around the store. He has gotten into the caramel, gotten into the kitchen, rewrapped things in tissue paper all over the store, and he's even gotten into the bar.
Oh, boy. That sounds problematic. So Sweet Pete's staff there is busy making candy for the holidays, and you're asking actually the public to come help locate Jolly Pop? Is that what we're calling him, Jolly Pop?
Jolly Pop the elf, yes. Come and locate him, and if you do, you will get a lollipop.
Oh,
and
come on.
He's doing something new every day, and there's new mischief every day that's probably going to happen through Christmas.
So the reward is a lollipop for finding Jolly Pop?
Yes.
Okay, that's deep. So what are some of the holiday candies you're featuring this year? You guys always have a great lineup.
Well, of course, our sea salt caramel is the most popular all year round, but it's especially popular now. And we have all kinds of gifts for just about every price range. We have everything from caramel popcorn baskets in every range. So there's really a gift for whatever the occasion is or whatever you need to find. So we have a whole wide variety of stuff.
What's your
assortment boxes?
What's your personal favorite this year?
I love the Butter Crunch. It's made with peanut butter. I would say it's sort of an elevated Butterfinger. It's something that we make ourselves with my own recipe. It has a nice light, flaky, peanut buttery crunch, and it's coated in milk or dark chocolate.
What's a good entry level candy for your new customers at Sweet Pete's?
Really, if you love caramel, that's probably the best. I think we have the best caramel around.
Okay. I'm gonna take call, see if anybody has an objection to that. But talk about this store. Sweet Pete's has been in business for a number of years now. Tell us, for people who may not be familiar with this downtown confectionery, like, what is unique about it?
Well, so what's unique about Sweet Pete's is that we bring you into the process of candy making. So we have classes and parties and field trips that sort of revolve around candy making and sort of bring you into the process. It's a 22,000 square foot building. It's an old historic building that we renovated into a candy theme. It used to be the old Seminole Club. And we maintained all the historic elements and just added candy and made it fun. And so it's a place where people could come in and make memories. It's a place where when you come in with your family and friends, you'll always remember, and it's a good time. It's something that is providing happiness to people.
And
we use candy as our medium.
Yeah, who designed this store? It really is such a cool place to visit and very fanciful decorations and all. Kind of who envisioned that?
Well, we all kind of envisioned it, but as far as the decorations and the seasonality of it goes, our designer is a guy by the name of John Fabiano, and he comes in and redecorates for every season. So each time somebody comes in, it's a new experience. So right now it's Christmas, and then at the first of the year will be Valentine's Day, and then there's a summer theme, Halloween. So it's always a different experience, and we try to make it a little different every time we decorate. And so, but he does an excellent job.
Pete, I've got a call from Charles. He's got a question about a certain candy. Good morning, Charles. Go ahead. You're on First Coast Connect.
Well, good morning, everybody. Hi, Pete. Do you have those cherries that are like chocolate-fied with the stems still on them, but they're not really like, you know, not like maraschinos that are dipped in chocolate or covered with chocolate, but these are just like a, the whole cherry is like a chocolate shell. Do you know which one? They had them at Peter Brooks years ago around Christmas.
Okay, so we have a cherry cordial. It is I consider it an elevated cherry cordial because it's not the typical bleached out maraschino. These are natural cherries. We soak them in Grand Marnier, and then we put a it's encased. There's like a syrup center that's encased in either milk or dark chocolate. And so we sell those. That's one of our most popular items, especially this time of year.
Well, thanks for the call. And lots of things going on at the candy shop right now. There's classes. There's cocktail and candy making classes. I've been speaking with Pete Berenger, owner and candy maker at Sweet Pete's. Pete, thank you so much for joining us, and watch out for that elf.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And that's our program. Join us Tuesday when we analyze legislation called Florida's Free Kill Law. It's a law allowing only the spouse or child of a descendant to seek damages in medical malpractice cases. If you missed anything with our program today, check out the rebroadcast at 8 p.m. or find today's show at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey Bennett. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer. Our director is Brady Corum. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.